2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 133, How High Is Up? Blue Skying in the Literary Stratosphere, a panel discussion featuring Alex Caldero, Lynn Butler Oaks, Gino Skye, and Paul Swenson.
I believe we are beginning late because all my panel was here and where was I looking for them? But we found each other. And hallelujah. This is session 133, How High Is Up? Blue Skying in the Literary Stratosphere. To begin with, I need to announce that Lynn Butler Oaks, who was to participate on this panel, is in court this morning with a member of her family. And very graciously and at the last minute, Dorothy Solomon has agreed to be our fourth person. And here's what I want to say about Dorothy. She has a new book forthcoming from Norton. It's called Predators, Prey, and Other Kin, Stories of the Polygamous Underground. And Dorothy is a middle child. She is the 28th of 48 children of Rulon Allred, the polygamist who was assassinated years ago. And Dorothy is the author of In My Father's House, which was about her experience growing up in a polygamous household. We'll start with Dorothy. Then Alex Caldero. I'm just going to read the description in the program. Text artist, word shaker, maker of things that at times resemble music, at times poetry, and at times the shape of your own mind. Gino Skye, who has a MA degree in humanities from San Francisco State University, the author of, among other things, Appaloosa Rising and The Legend of the Cowboy Buddha. Gino, who is from Idaho, is now a Utah resident. And so this is a coming out party in Utah for Gino, who's read here many times. But anyway. I will be fourth, and we'll go from there. Dorothy Solomon.
Well, thank you for being here. I don't know whether to feel dismayed or delighted that writers seem to be such an elite company at this conference, but I'm so grateful for your audience. And as I approach the final drafts and the copy editing of my book, I know that my tension is mounted, and I feel that speaking out today, being able to read what I've written aloud and gauge that, the impact of that on the world, it will be good for me, and I hope it's time well spent for you. I'm going to read from a piece called Sister Wife, which was pretty well unearthed from the bottom of, exhumed from the bottom of the ocean and brought to print because of the dedication of another writer. I wonder if I have the right to tell Alma's story, even though hers is a singular story and some good may come of telling it. Alma's story reflects the human dilemma, the dissonance of our idealism when faced with hard reality. In a family that aspires to godlike perfection, Alma's apparent insufficiencies became a reminder that life doesn't always look the way we want it to look. My people pride themselves in serving divine will, a particularly incontestable form of hubris, which tends to separate and isolate rather than unify. Alma's ordeal speaks of humility and vulnerability, opening a plot of common ground where we all struggle to understand why we're here. She broke that ground while tracking her own shadow, and in claiming her dark side became somehow perfect, in the sense of whole or complete. Alma and I are sisters, half-sisters really, but because my father insisted that in the principle of plural marriage, we were all one family, we called each other sister and we meant it. Alma has other sisters, like Karen, who is 7 years her senior, an imperious beauty with a magisterial temperament. But none is so like Alma as I am. Born less than a year apart, both lacking birth certificates that could be used against our parents in court, we mirrored each other's age, temperament, and coloring, as well as the angst of doubting our right to be here. Alma began a lifelong obsession with horses the night our mothers wrapped us in blankets and stuffed us into the big back seat of the Green Hudson. Another raid was brewing. We must escape the authorities that could take us from our mothers, the forces that could put our grown-ups in jail, things that had happened to our people in the World War 2 years before Alma and I were born. When we returned from Mexico 3 months later, Alma was nearly dead of dysentery. That brush with death got her hooked up with a tall sorrel horse she named Babe. She wasn't strong enough to hoist a saddle, so she'd leap from the fence and hang over his bare back and kick one leg across. Then, clutching his long mane, she'd streak across the bare fields. Aunt Melissa said it was a caution. Ladies rode side saddle for a reason, and Sally should stop that girl before it was too late. But Aunt Sally gave her daughter what she wanted. In fact, everyone gave Alma what she wanted, everyone except her older sister, Karen. A fierce love burned between the sisters as if Karen knew Alma's frailty and intended to train it to strength. Karen reminded Alma that in the United Order she could not really own a horse. It would belong to everyone, and Alma should let the boys ride the horse and get started on her hope chest like other girls in the family. In 1955, as the McCarthy Reign of Terror ended and the Cold War mounted, another polygamous roundup scattered my father's family to the four winds. Alma left Babe with the neighbors, and after a brief sojourn with us, Aunt Sally headed north and with Karen and Alma in tow. My mother and Aunt Alma took us west and established a home in Nevada while our father closed down the doors to his doctor's office and went into hiding. But Alma and I wrote faithfully to each other, postcards in first-grade printing, and later neat penmanship on pale pink paper. Several years later, as the political focus shifted to foreign policies in places like Cuba and Southeast Asia, we returned to Utah, and Alma began dating a feisty young man from our religious group. Rowdy had grown up on a ranch in Montana that was gradually being settled by our people into a township made up of 10-acre parcels, each family with its own sustainability, the way Brigham Young had said it should be. Rowdy knew how to ride horses and drive a tractor and make hay. He was attracted to Alma, and she to him. At least once a month he made the long journey past Yellowstone Park and through the Badlands of Idaho to be with her. He was free-spirited, and the brethren worried about him. Karen, who had been married for 4 or 5 years by then and knew something about men, said Alma could never keep such a wild horse in hand. Aunt Melissa predicted Rowdy would one day leave the group, and some said Alma was too tender to survive out in the world where the natural man rules and hearts are godless. The year I graduated from high school, Karen played the part of the indulgent older sister and gave a slumber party for the teenage girls in my father's family. Karen's husband, Caleb, had spent the years of their marriage furbishing a strong brick dwelling with apartments upstairs and down. His second wife lived in the basement with her new baby and took care of Karen's three little children that night as we popped corn and put on our pajamas and told stories about the old days. Yet my stomach cramped all evening, not from food or excitement, but because I felt ill at ease with my own sisters. By then I was questioning everything, dating outside the group, and the mothers whispered that I was becoming worldly. Perhaps my jaded view stained the innocence of our girl talk that night, but our remarks seemed barbed with darker, sharper truths than those spoken aloud. Alma left the room to take a phone call, and when she returned, Karen spoke pointedly. "See how he can't go a whole evening without calling you? It isn't right for a man who's going to live the principle to be so gone on one girl." "You think he has a weak character?" Alma asked. "You're meant for someone like Caleb, someone who can take a firm hand with you." Karen's voice carried the authority of all older sisters. "But if she loves Rowdy," I started. Both sisters turned to look at me. I had the awkward sense I'd broken into a conversation that had been going on for years. The next time I saw Alma, it was a year or more later, she showed me her hope chest full of linens edged with hand-crocheted lace and embroidered flowers, crafted while I was writing papers. for my classes at the university. I shook my head and wondered what had happened to Alma's love of horses. She told me that she and Rowdy had broken up for good, and she had decided to become Caleb's third wife. The wedding ceremony would be secret, and I was not invited. I had jumped the fence around our religious group by then, and people I had known all my life called me a troublemaker. So after a glass of lemonade, we hurried off in opposite directions. The next time I saw Alma and Karen, the occasion was my own baby shower, a shower thrown by big-hearted Aunt Sally, who must have known that my due date was a mere 8 months beyond my wedding. Alma was happy for me, seemed happy for everyone. She occupied the back bedroom of Karen's house. She was a sister wife. And that is where Alma's story really begins, a story that in many ways excludes me. I only know of it through other family members, through the few spare words Alma and I spoke when it was over, and through the knowing that defies time and space, the knowing of the heart. As potential mothers in Israel, we had inherited the legacy of Sarah, who laughed when a messenger from God told her she would have a son in her old age, and then gave birth to Isaac. In our little field, a woman's raison d'etre was to raise a righteous seed unto the Lord. What good was a woman among plural wives if she could not bear children? The childless woman in our group often became strange and witch-like with their herbs and their sorrow. Some stood in meeting and made prophecies that were discounted before they were heard. A barren woman was at best a perpetual child to be patronized and at worst a creature to be pitied. When Alma did not conceive, Aunt Melissa blamed it on the bareback riding and lifting heavy saddles, but the infertility was more likely due to the staph infection she caught while assisting in our father's office during the first year of marriage. The infection rampaged through her body, and none of my father's herbs contained it. Eventually, he forsook the naturopathic way and used medicine that allowed him medicine. He prescribed purging antibiotics that left Alma pale and bedridden. She lay in the back bedroom waiting for the tides of her life to turn, but the tide did not turn. 7 years after our father was killed, the year the banks of the Great Salt Lake obliterated the bird refuges and submerged the newly constructed Salt Air Resort, Alma and I met in a Greek restaurant near our father's office. We ordered food with names we could not pronounce. We mused sadly that the doctor's domain had become an insurance agency. By the time we met, Alma had made her decision, and there was no changing it. On the basis of our shared history, I imagine Alma on that night when everything became clear. In my mind's eye, I see her arriving after work to help with the birth of Caleb's and Karen's ninth child. I imagine her lapsing into a moment of pretense that the eight children bathed and dressed and kneeling before the fireplace are hers. We say our prayers to the fire, Joseph the youngest says, in his self-satisfied way. We don't pray to the fire, Joseph, Alma says. We pray facing north, and we pray to God. But how do you know God is north, Rachel asks. I thought he was straight up. Rachel, 5 minutes don't pass without you asking impossible questions. Alma sighs and straightens her long, lean frame. We kneel facing north because that's where the lost tribes will come from when they rescue the remnant of Israel in the last days. Your grandfather used to say that the city of Enoch was translated and taken to the North Star to be near Kolob, where God lives. As I imagine the scene, I wonder if Alma believes the litany she recites for Karen and Caleb's children. I think she must have clung to belief in something. Otherwise, how did she get through that day? Caleb, she calls, as though she is his mother. Caleb, we're waiting. And then to Rachel, get your father for prayers. Perhaps Joseph leans against her, asking, where's Mama? And Alma strokes his hair. Your Mama is having a baby. And then Caleb enters that distant gaze in his cobalt eyes. He kneels before the fireplace, back to everyone, the family patriarch, doing his duty. Hush now, Alma whispers to the children. Fold your arms. Caleb gives her a bemused smile, then speaks in a deep trombone, our dear Father in heaven, and the other voices chime in, our dear Father in heaven. Caleb prays for rain. He prays for peace. He prays that dear Karen will be delivered safely. He prays that the Lord will bless Alma with the desire of her heart. And after each plea, the children echo, please bless dear Alma with the desire of her heart. Alma clenches her arms and holds her body rigid. Perhaps she can feel the wind in her mind or sparks crackling behind her eyelids. At last, the prayer is over and the children file up to kiss Caleb and Alma goodnight And Rachel says, "Shiley, will you tuck us in, Aunt Alma?" She nods, feeling Caleb's sticky gaze on her. At last, the children are folded in neat and silent as 8 white sheets on linen shelves. Alma descends to the kitchen and mixes bread in the blue porcelain pan. The cool batter salves her nerves. From the back bedroom float the voices of Karen and Caleb. They have phoned the midwife, and now they are choosing a name for the baby. As always, Caleb has left things for the last minute. She tells them that he bought her the gold wedding band only an hour before he slipped it on her finger. She doesn't tell the girls at work that it is the 3rd wedding band he had bought, or that she has sister wives. She could lose her job over that. She smiles wryly, remembering the ceremony where Karen took Alma's hand and offered it to Caleb, and he covered both their hands with his and then pushed the gold band onto her ring finger. Back then, the band had been too tight. Now her fingers are so thin, the ring swivels, it could easily be lost in the bread dough. Karen mused weakly from the bedroom. "Alma, what are you doing in there?" "I want you to be here when this baby comes." The hint of something behind Karen's firm words, something Alma's prayed for, hovers almost palpably. "I'll be in as soon as I've set the bread to rise," Alma calls back. She reaches into the flower bin. She is at home here as anywhere, had once decorated and lived in the back room where she will stay tonight. Caleb put those walls up when she agreed to marry him. Karen had chosen the wallpaper. Sometimes Karen came into the new room, broom and dustcloth in hand, rousing Alma, still curved within Caleb's crescent form, to explain that she had saved this room to clean for last, and wasn't it time everyone in the house was up? After the infection, Alma had moved to an apartment. Now she is a guest, Aunt Alma, come to delight the children with molasses cookies. She has too much time to bake. Of course she has every right to be here. Each month she turns her paycheck over to Caleb, who manages the family's united order. Karen's needs are great. Alma's needs are small. The tiny apartment, a few clothes, the little she eats. Although she is better about eating now. Alma gets satisfaction from providing for her older sister, who's given her so much, sewed her wedding dress, handed down shoes and half-completed diaries, and shared her husband. "I'm a hand-me-down girl," she thinks, then stops to reframe her thoughts. She pushes the dough away, then pulls it toward her, tugging it apart with each movement of her arms, shaping it into something palatable and nourishing, something to replace the dark red anger that nearly ate her alive. At first, time at the apartment complex where she dwelled among divorced people and old couples had been luxurious. On her nights with Caleb, they played chess, read poetry aloud, slept in until 7. Perhaps his face softened during those mornings alone, sharing stories of his boyhood and choosing names for babies to come. But the babies didn't come. "Alma, I forgot to wash the bedroom with disinfectant." Karen would have roused her sister from her reverie by now. Alma hears her, rinses the dough from her hands, dries them carefully. She draws a bucket of warm water and pours in a pine-smelling disinfectant that turns it milky, the fragrance of birth. In her childhood, fundamentalist houses filled with this smell signaled the advent of a new brother or sister or cousin, and now nieces and nephews. The smell brings tears to Alma's eyes. She pauses at the door of the bedroom, puts down the bucket, and closes her eyes until the tears are gone. Then with a deep breath, she enters. Caleb's raw-boned frame roosts at the bottom of the bed as he softly reads scripture. Karen sits against the pillows, her dark hair spread against white pillow slips, embroidered with pink roses. Alma had worked these sheets and cases for a month and gave them to Karen at Christmas. Karen had smiled tearfully and vowed to use them only for special occasions, a promise that left Alma imagining what those occasions might be. It was a memorable Christmas, the same Christmas she had ended up in the hospital. Alma was strong enough to work 12-hour shifts, but she'd been fasting for 72 hours. And Christmas bore down like a vise, the children opening their stockings, Karen's announcement that a new one was on the way. The queasiness in Alma's stomach rose to her heart. As they were sitting down to Christmas dinner, Alma rushed from the house, leaving her coat draped on the hall tree and Karen open-mouthed beside Caleb. Alma had rushed to her little car, had driven through the cold, empty streets until it started snowing and she could no longer see. She only vaguely felt the bump of the other car, the door pressed against her hip, the cold windshield soothing her forehead like the cool cloth the mothers had used when she was so sick in Mexico. In Karen's bedroom, Alma presses a cloth dipped in ice water to her sister wife's forehead, but Karen removes it and sits up. She fixes Alma with her bright eyes. Are you all right, Alma? Alma laughs and shakes her head. You're the one in labor. She turns away and takes the cloth from the bundle of oven-sterilized towels. Caleb begins reading again, his voice like soft thunder. Alma washes the headboard and footboard and the dresser with disinfectant, drying the wood as she goes. She wipes the knickknacks in the frame of Grandmother Evelyn's picture. Perhaps she remembers how when we were children, Grandmother Evelyn was always complaining about our noise, yet once in a while she'd pull us in onto her lap and tell of the days when she had ridden her mare bareback through the Star Valley countryside. I was a happy girl, she'd say. What happened, we asked. Grandmother would dip her white head, then raise it. Too much to do. I had my own children, and when Charlotte died with her 7, I raised 16 in all. Don't make over much of babies, my girls. Babies don't always bring happiness, and they always bring work. Now Karen speaks in the deep silence. Caleb, Alma, and I need to have a little talk. Alma, Karen begins after Caleb leaves. Each time I've given birth, I've wanted. Her face bleaches white as bone. Wanted to have the strength to do this. Before it was too hard, and we hoped you would still be able to. But now, with no chance for you at all, I worry about you, and I've been so blessed. Then she stops as pain grips her face, and then surprise. My water just broke. I hope the midwife hurries. Alma starts up. I'll send Caleb for her. I'm just going to skip a few pages and tell you that in the hospital, Alma had something like a psychotic break, and in the process of that, decided that she was having a baby. When the doctor, a kind young man, came to her and said, you're not in labor, then they had this conversation. The young doctor sat still and he says, I'm Dr. Monroe and I'm getting you out of this. He said, unbuckling one strap and then the other. He lifted the sheet, his fingers probed. Alma, you're not having a baby. Do you understand? Tell me what's causing you so much pain. And then the storm of weeping while the young man rocked her like a baby. The blurting of secrets she'd sworn to keep about the principal, about Caleb, about Karen. The doctor sat still and silent for a long time. Maybe if you and your husband could go away alone for a while. Alma shook her head and blew her nose. They think I'm jealous, and I am, and I have no right to be. Every woman has the right to be jealous, he said. Not of Karen. I love Karen. What do you mean? Then, hot tears ran down her cheeks. When we were married, my father asked, why do you enter into this covenant? And I knew I couldn't say, because that's what I'm supposed to do. That isn't reason enough. Our people serve God, and so I gave the right answer. To raise a righteous seed unto the Lord. It's the only good reason to live the principle, and I can't fulfill it. The young doctor sighed. Let me talk to your husband. Things can be done. Amazing advances in fertility research. So then Caleb comes to the hospital. She introduced him to the young doctor, gesticulating in a frantic dance of fingers, her heart rising in a joyous wave. Please, Caleb, Alma begged when Dr. Monroe had left. Caleb shook his head and blushed. The problem's not with me, Alma. I have children. She bit her lip and turned her face away. She stared at a painting of a woman in her white nightgown holding her baby at the window. She stared at it until Caleb went away. So began her lonely visits to the fertility clinic, the humiliation of tests that lit her insides up for the camera, and the medications, much later exploratory surgery, and the bills requiring longer hours of work and an extra job. At the hospital, she was always alone, even when her mother and Karen were there, an aloneness so deep and long it seemed to have begun with her own birth. Caleb came to visit her when she was recovering from her hysterectomy. Why did you come? She asked. You are my other rib, he said gently. Then I'm a broken rib. Don't worry, Alma. You have one ovary. God can do anything, even if there were no ovaries. He would bless you with a child if you had enough faith. Think of Sarah of old. Think of Aunt Laverne, who waited 12 years, and Aunt Emma, who waited 18. And she pulled back from him and looked him straight in the face. They've done everything they can for me, Caleb. Now they need your help. There's a process that increases the chances 50%. They've done it with cows and mares for a long time. Artificial insemination. Caleb flushed. Alma, we are not animals. But Caleb, you have children. You don't know what it's like. We must have faith. We must fast and pray. This made her shriek. If she'd been stronger, she'd have gone after him with her nails. I have had faith, enough to let them cut me open. She pulled herself up, ignoring the stab of pain, and grabbed his hand. Please, Caleb. Dr. Monroe says it's simple. They just take you into a little room and give you a jar and leave you alone. No one will see. A look of repulsion crossed his face, and he backed away. God would know. And that was when her heart sank into the sea of her rage. When she spoke, her voice was authoritative. I'm not the one who has no faith. And her mouth closed like a deadbolt. That was when she began to truly live alone. She attended counseling sessions with a kind, strong woman. She visited Dr. Monroe one last time to say goodbye. Dr. Monroe promised that if he came across a baby through channels, she would be the first to know. It's really hard for a polygamous wife to adopt a baby for reasons you might gather. Alma gathered her things in a whirl, banging her hip on the corner of the desk as she backed out the door. Thanks, Dr. Monroe, but I'm going to make myself happy. And she had made herself happy. She found other seeds inside her and saw them sprout and flourish. Her work took on new dimension. She began to enjoy coffee breaks with the other seamstresses, drinking hot lemonade while they smoked and stirred sugar into their black coffee. Wednesday afternoon, she took classes in dressmaking. She bought a stereo system and a sound library of Mozart, Beethoven, and Chopin to keep her company as she worked. Caleb's infrequent visits interrupted her concentration. Even on the nights he slept at her apartment, she stayed up late, the light at the drafting table throwing her magnified silhouette on the wall. Come to bed, Alma, Caleb would say. I have things to do. Don't lose sight of that which is truly important, he intoned. She said nothing. Perhaps she had lost sight of what was important, but children's clothing, long crinolines, calicoes, pinafores, spun in her mind. Someday she would sew her creations, her name finely embroidered at the neck of each garment. She held back her checks from the United Order to buy a filly that she named Spirit. But now she knows that, and astride that filly, Alma was whole. But now she knows that Kieran will offer up her ninth child, a sacrifice to sisterhood. And Alma's fine balance wavers. Kieran wants to change the balance. Caleb wants to change the balance. Maybe God wants to change the balance. The dark window washes with headlights. The midwife hurries in with her bag of instruments. I wish it was you, Alma, she says. Don't. I'm fine. Really, I am. Now get in there where you both belong. Always before, Alma had stayed in the room during Kieran's birthing, standing at the foot of the bed as if trying to learn the miracle by heart. But tonight when Kieran calls to her, Alma brings a cold towel for her forehead, eyes for her cracked lips, then disappears to the kitchen to test the bread. She wants to be strong enough to accept what is real, to serve others as she can, like these loaves of bread, plain and simple, or dressed up with honey and fresh milk, something honest and true. And when the midwife calls, hurry, Alma, it's time. And Caleb's soft rumble, Alma, you'll miss it. Alma calls back, as soon as I get this bread out of the oven, and the baby's burbling cry, and it is too late. Later, when the loaves are turned out of their tins and the crusts swathed in butter, when Kieran and the baby have been bathed, and when the midwife has bestowed a shadowy kiss, and an I'm sorry it wasn't you, Kieran's voice drifts down the hall, Alma, darling, come here. And so Alma gets up from the table where she has been staring out of the night. Alma, Kieran reaches for her. Alma kisses her sister's supple cheek. Alma, grimacing with afterpain, Kieran holds Alma's hand for a moment, then takes a small white bundle and holds it out. Take this. I want you to have her. Name her. Keep her as if she were your own. Alma looks at Kieran, then back at the baby. She forces herself to breathe slow and deep. Her own. Her sister's child. Her husband's child. Almost like her own. Now looking down at the tiny wrinkled face, she's filled with a temptation, strong as starvation, something to fill her life. She looks past Kieran's strangled smile. If you be the Son of God, turn these stones into bread. She could take it, keep it, let the world witness her worth. Alma holds the baby close. The warmth fills her chest and spreads to the cavity of her womb, as if she were your own. Perhaps a flicker of recognition flits through the baby's blank blue eyes. There is no as if. Things are or they are not. And in that instant, she knows something. Something of this child really does belong to her, just as something of Joseph and Rachel, of Karen and Caleb, and even Dr. Monroe. In some way, everyone belongs to her. She looks at her sister. There's no use pretending she can do things Karen's way. The lost tribes will not rescue her. On earth, we must rescue ourselves, must reach with open arms to receive salvation, permit ourselves to be refined into something irreducible, something worth offering. Karen, thank you, but it wouldn't work. She's beautiful, but she's yours, yours and Caleb's. But what will you do? Live my life, Karen. It's precious as that baby's. Open mouth, staring, Karen takes the child, tears suddenly gone. Alma notices that her heart still beats strong and that the feeling of fullness has not left her. Illusions take up a lot of space. When they're gone, life flows in. As she walks down the hall, Caleb stops her. Did Karen tell you? Isn't it a miracle, her willingness to give so unselfishly? Alma smiles. She told me, but Karen has already given too much. Besides, don't you know, Caleb, the miracle has already happened. He smiles not because he understands, but because she is smiling. Alma decides not to spend the night here, no matter how it strikes everyone. She floats on a draft out the door of the wonderful old house, and there she stands looking up. From habit, she searches at the pole star, then throws her arms skyward. Thank you, she says, surrendering to countless bright holes in a dark blue blanket.
Salvation to be had. Angelus Silesius. The shadow belongs to the light. Dr. Jung. Ergo, that's it. I, next to T. T, a grown-up I, a fully developed me. Dreamt that God, the great mysterious being behind and beyond everything, was a cantankerous and grumpy old lady threatening to kick everybody's ass. Seven. According to the charts, this is gonna be your lucky day. 2 and 5 lucky years later, you don't know what's what. 2 plus 5 equals 7. 207 is the total on the bill, and your hope is rekindled like some Vegas junkie numbers man superstitious herding fool. Seven. Come on, seven. At this point, a bunch of words write themselves, and I just watch them come and go, wait for my cue and jump in. Go tell that old man he was full of it, him and his charts. Seers are blind when they peer into human hearts. Shamans, shams, ripoffs. It's too big, the human heart. Soul too big for clairvoyance. Chest hurts, it's so big. Chest bursts, it's so big. Chest rips open, it's so big. Make a monkey out of me. Take money out of me. Shake down. Hear a series of voices interrupt and say things that just can't be. Too bad I can't have them for dinner. I go to my confessor. Bless me, Father, for I have hope. Blast me, Father, then I can cope. Or something like that, for here, too, the voices take off on their own. I'm on a roll. Can do no wrong. Fill up a whole book with written drawings and scrawls, write on rocks even. Have no worry about my health, in no hurry to doubt my death. Take a chance. Un coup the day, the soup of the day. Seven. Come on, seven. Dream. I'm with George W. Bush, President of the United States of America. We are by a lake, and it is winter. Papa Bush is there, and Mama Bush is there. It's a family gathering, and I'm one of the family. We are all by a lake, and it's winter, and it's a Bush family tradition to play the diving game. So George, President W. Bush, gets up and dives into the icy water and goes down deep and then surfaces and leaps right onto the shore. That looks dangerous, I say. Why do you do it? He answers, you got to go in to get out. my complicated mind makes my life complicated. Said Z, I am Zephyr. You are zero, said the Lord. Said Y, I am Youth. You are yoked, said the Lord. Said X, I am Axis. You are X'd, said the Lord. Said W, I am Wonder. You are Withered, said the Lord. Said V, I am Victory. You are Vanquished, said the Lord. Said U, I am Ultimate. You are Under, said the Lord. Said T, I am Towering. You are Tiny, said the Lord. Said S, I am Selected. You are Slime, said the Lord. Said R, I am Right. You are Wrong, said the Lord. Said Q, I am Quick. You are Quits, said the Lord. Said P, I am Pure. You are Putrid, said the Lord. Said O, I am On. You are Off, said the Lord. Said N, I am Necessary. You are Nothing, said the Lord. Said M, I am Man. You are Monster, said the Lord. Said L, I am Light. You are Lie, said the Lord. Said K, I am Kind. You are Kill, said the Lord. Said J, I am Jewel. You are Junk, said the Lord. Said I am an Intelligent. You are Inane, said the Lord. Said H, I am Heaven. You are Hell, said the Lord. Said G, I am Great. You are Grime, said the Lord. Said F, I am Friend. You are Fiend, said the Lord. Said E, I am Excellent. You are Excrement, said the Lord. Said D, I am Daybreak. You are Doom, said the Lord. Said C, I am Cold. You are Cancelled, said the Lord. The person who sits at a table that's all set up and is satisfied by merely looking must have already eaten. Who sets a table and won't let you eat must have someone else in mind. What are we talking about? Table, food, eating. It's about us and how we offer ourselves and to whom we offer ourselves. Bon appetit. This evening, my daughter asked me, how do we know we're not dreaming right now? And I remembered the story of the one who dreamt he was a butterfly. And when I woke up, he was not sure whether he had dreamt the butterfly or if the butterfly was dreaming him. I looked for the story in my books, not to answer her question, but to show her how old her question is. that it's a good question, a question worth keeping alive. And maybe after a while, as tadpole becomes frog, this question may become something else, nothing like its old self, and transformed, walk out of the water into the air and not drown. Beautiful, idyllic, isn't it? Beautiful, idyllic, isn't it? Beautiful, idyllic. Isn't it? Beautiful! Idyllic! Isn't it? Beautiful! Idyllic! Isn't it? Prayer. Lord, don't screw around with the tomatoes. Make them and get it over with. Nobody else can do what you do. After all, you are God. Make them red. This is no time for second thoughts. Don't forget the seeds. This is no time to change the design. Experiment later, which for you is eternity. Don't disappoint your devotees. Round or oval, you know what to do. Don't let the fact that you are omnipotent go to your head. This ain't the time for innovative thinking. The spring is coming and the gardens are waiting. The iridologist leaned forward and looked deep into my eyes.
Your eyes are not really brown, she said. Your eyes are blue.
Then she explained, this is because your system is clogged.
Only by cleaning out your system will your eyes shine with their true color, which, as I said before, is not brown, but blue.
This is the situation. The cats are inside. The dogs are outside. Too old to learn to live together, we keep them separate, or all hell would break loose. If you ask what efforts have been made to teach them about each other or introduce them to each other, we'd have to say none. This is the scene. The cats and dogs are kept apart with no idea of cohabitation. I have arrived. I will arrive. We have arrived. We will arrive at this as the only solution. This is the way things are. Dogs outside. Cats inside, vigilant over the doors that these worlds may never collide. Thank you so much.
For the last week or so, I've been debating on which story to read. One about my mother, or one about my first rites of passage, and both of them have to deal with being inside and going outside the Mormon church. But I decided, after listening to all these great writers so far, this is the place where I want to go with this one. It takes place in Pocatello, Idaho. And it is called The Complete Trombone History of Mankind. Sooner or later, anyone who is a member of the Mormon Church must stand up in front of all the other members and perform. Do their thing, no matter whether he or she has a thing or not. It doesn't matter if you're shy, suffering from a chronic speech impediment, a hunchback with prickly heat, a drunkard, or a dirty, no-good spitballer. Eventually, the higher-ups will get you on stage and make you find an act. Yodel, cry, talk about how God saved your spinach from the earwigs, or just stand pigeon-toed and run the zipper of your fly up and down in 3-4 times. Sooner or later, you must do something. I remember when my neighbor girlfriend was hit by lightning while walking to school. As soon as she was released from the hospital, she had to get up in front of our church members and tell them how she had been saved by God from being burned and fried like a skinny-ass shoestring potato. And what had really saved her was a yellow plastic beanie with a red propeller that turned in the wind. The lightning melted the beanie right into her hair and couldn't go any further. Her parents had to fix her up with a wig, false eyebrows and eyelashes, and gobs of lipstick so she could stand up on Sunday morning to bear her testimony to God, Jesus, and the Holy Ghost. And then there was the time Mrs. Turner told how her husband had been run over by a freight train just south of Blackfoot. And where his secret Mormon garments covered his body, there wasn't a scratch on him. He was dead. But by sweet loving Jesus, his body had been saved from mutilation by his amazing underwear. Everyone had a miracle. Even my friends got up and told strange stories that I knew were not true. But I figured they had as much right to lie as anyone else. I slowly began to realize that all you had to do to make a story become a miracle was tell it in church, laced with pipe organ music, light shining through stained glass, two women crying, a sinner on his knees, and beautiful flowers hanging in wicker baskets. And then all dreams, visions, and good old bullshit become the golden voice of truth. If you were to tell the same story in a bar, you'd get thrown out on your ass in 10 seconds flat. I knew that someday I would have to get up there and do something, but I had no idea what I could do. I was 16 years old and searching for my miracle. 1 week before Easter, I had the strange feeling that my theatrical virginity was going to collide head-on with destiny. I had stalled them off long enough, and the higher-ups were running out of truth to feed their flock. That morning, the bishop found me making out in the sacrament room with the sinner's daughter when I should have been getting the bread and water ready for the sacraments. "Buddy, when are you going to do something?" he said, eyeing the girl. Guilt. That was my downfall, and I fell right into his trap. His eyes were burning donuts through my Holy Ghost as he patted the ass of my new girlfriend. "I can't do nothing. I stutter and stammer when I get in front of people. I've never had a vision, I can't read very well, and I can't even play the accordion. Maybe I could go out there and show them how to bulldog a steer. How about that?" As I was showing the bishop how I was going to bulldog steer, my girlfriend took off, and for a lot of strange reasons, she immediately joined the Catholic Church. The bishop was getting angry, and his eyes looked like a summer storm had moved in. There was a tornado in one eye and a hurricane in the other one. No one turns down the bishop. I hear you've been taking trombone lessons. Oh, shit, who told you that? Never mind, next Sunday I want you up there giving us a trombone solo. But I can't, I said. I don't know nothing except the scales. And I felt my heart trying to skydive right out of my mouth. He raised his body into a full 10 feet of authority and power, and I saw in his eyes all of the covered wagons coming across the plains and the women pushing hand carts 1,000 miles, and I heard the voice of God telling the Mormons to get their dreams across the sagebrush, and I saw that all of their angels were doing push-ups just to stay in shape. And then I saw my bishop's tongue become the bullwhip of the Mormon Empire. Learn something, pray, and perhaps God will help you. And he flew out of the room so fast, I felt like a small, simple, and lonely pilgrim standing alone on a tall mountain after the deluge. My trombone teacher cracked up when I told him what had happened. He said it was impossible for me to learn anything that quickly and refused to help. All during the week, I tried to learn Mendelssohn's On Wings of Song, but I couldn't hit any of the high notes and very few of the lows. So on Saturday night, I got down on my knees and I prayed my ass off, hoping for a divine revelation. And just before I finished, I snuck in a little P.S. to the cowboy Buddha, my secret God hero. The next morning, all of the flowers were a peacock of arrogance on this day of the triple header, Sunday, Easter, and the first day of spring. I went down into the basement of the church and prepared for my debut. I shined up my old pawn shop trombone as best I could, and I even tried to pound out a few dents with the heels of my new cowboy boots. And then I took a gallon of bubble soap and poured it into the bell of my old trombone. The group singing was over, and I knew I was next. I went upstairs and waited behind the altar until the bishop called my name. And now Buddy Sky will give us a trombone solo. My knees were shaking so much the bell in the steeple began to sing. But somehow I got out in front of the congregation. And I found my mother in the audience so I could get some strength by looking at her beautiful face. I even tried to say something about my search for the miracle, but my words came out sounding like a brain gargoyle. So I put my trombone up to my lips, and I closed my eyes. I said a short airmail special delivery prayer to my superhero, the cowboy Buddha, and then I blew out one of the finest bubbles in the history of mankind. At first, there was a long-held silence, as if a real miracle had actually happened. And then I heard a few laughs and giggles, and I opened up my eyes just in time to see my mother cover up her head with her new spring coat. And I saw my amazing bubble floating in the air with the first day of spring Easter sun diving right through the middle. And then the people stopped squirming in their seats. They stopped picking their noses and hitting their kids with sound books, and they raised their eyes to the heavens of the church. And inside that first bubble was the sweet, smiling face of Jesus in Vista Vision color and quadraphonic sound. The next bubble I blew out came looking like a watermelon. It tumbled around until it found its own circle, and then it started for the sun. The 12 apostles were inside washing the feet of Jesus, and Judas was even laughing. I blew out another, and Jesus was standing on home plate in the 1929 World Series. The next came out multicolored and side-ordered with angel smoke, and Jesus was auditioning in an Easter egg zoot suit at the Apollo Theater in New York City. There were two bedroom scenes we had never read about in the Bible, and then a complete full-blown orgy came rumbling right out the bell of my old pawn shop trombone. and I knew I was in real trouble. I tried to knock it down with a slide of the trombone, but it got away and took off for an open window high in the roof of the church. A few Mayan gods in full ceremonial dress snuck out in Aztec bubbles, and then Satchel Paige and Mary Queen of Scots came running nude through a field of pink daisies. My church members were beginning to yell at me. They were trying to knock down the bubbles with songbooks and purses, but their shots were falling way too short. I knew I had to leave, but before I split, I gave them one more super bubble that was produced and directed as the complete, unexpurgated life of mankind. And that was it. It was like the great and famous sonic fart in church, and it blew them right out of their seats. They started throwing their songbooks and purses at me, and then I got hit by a pint bottle of George Dickel's Saramash Bourbon No. 12. So I blew them an encore, and it was the cowboy Buddha riding a Brahma bull right out through the third eye of God. I grabbed my magic trombone, and I ran for my life right up the guts of the church and out the gilded doors. My mother had fainted, but I knew I couldn't stop. I had to leave home sometime. The bishop was calling for the police as I cleared the front steps and headed for the highway. I stopped the first semi-truck leaving town and jumped in. He was going to San Francisco, and so was I. The bubbles had finally escaped, and they were catching the wind currents and floating all over town. The complete trombone picture show of mankind. And by God, they were going to San Francisco, too. Thank you.
Gosh, to follow Dorothy Solomon, Alice Caldiero, and Gino Sky. Whoa. You ever thought about how strange it is that we do theology in a series of hotels all over town? This is called Eternal Digression. Symposia are rosier in heaven than in hell. In heaven, there are a series of hotels. The women in the corridors wear toreadors and gowns and shorts. Some men wear ties, others jeans with button flies. We are uncorrelated here. Corrugated faces show the pain and character of who we've been, but are devoid of fear. We vibrate to each other's bodies, meanings, minds. We've come to burn some bridges with our friends and all the holy strangers of our past and future lives. In one hotel, God's in the suite called honeymoon. His prophet is in 504. Call girls whisper past these gilt-edged doors in stocking feet, wade the carpet ankle deep. At 3, room service brings a bite to eat. Beneath the great white beehive, buzz of silence is like ecstasy. Hum of symposium fills the days. Ballrooms are auditoriums where we speak, play, listen to the eddies of our blood. Flood of memory pools in every fingertip. We touch each other's lives like relics. Pass them. Watch as neighbors fondle our regrets. Her chest like sun, her chest the sun, her back the moon. Goddess rising in a glass-walled elevator. Floating a corridor, I enter the arms of a dark woman in white. In another hotel, I fell from her theological spell to find a daughter of noon who named herself Hope. We dine in a room at the bottom. Red-flocked wallpaper and lingerie fashion shows. Rows and rows of banquet tables recede in memory. progressive dinners in the Lafayette, the Grand, the Bonneville, beneath tricolored canopy on sloping green. Aftertaste is dream. Chartered buses move us in a night. Interior lights are out. Our destination blank. Across the tracks, City of God's urban underbelly swells with loneliness. All those ballrooms, all those banquet rooms, all those bedrooms, all those hotels. I wrote a poem about a street I lived on, 100 South. This is another street I lived on, 1100 East. Just down the street from the double entendre laundry, Christmas lights still sprinkle the houses on Valentine's night. Under the neon at the freewheeler, the yellow Volkswagen with the custom poet plate, idles to the muse of Muzak. The long black limousine that rolls up to the 7-Eleven spills out our own homegrown comedian and her leather-fringed daughter. They're making a pit stop, lingering a bit to shop for Slurpees before easing back to a late prowl that might become an all-nighter, since Rosie swore she won't go home no more to Lincoln Street now that her mom and dad as much as called her a liar and told the tabloids they never did lay a finger on her as a kid. At the Pubic Library. I am employed as a cofuse, to shampoo, condition, comb, measure, and then to codify and catalog as to cut, color, and curliness. In this vast repository of genital DNA, one can positively match a criminal to his or her crotch. My job's not kinky, as my friends seem to think. Rather routine and tedious, since it literally requires splitting hairs. But there, under the microscope, I sometimes find the coiled answer to a minute mystery that lightens my daily grind. If some otherwise bald bastard boasts hairbreadth escape from the evidentiary residue of the rapist's bed, my thoroughness may force his hand, defy his dare, bring that single strand to focus. Now I've got him dead by the short hair. In sleep. Yes, she slept with him. But did she sleep with him? She says she banged him, bawled him, overhauled his engine of desire and held his ankles to the flame. But did she sleep with him? Put out the fire, let go of consciousness, keep vigil with the dead. I think she left him lifeless, corpse wrapped in his bedclothes, blank face turned to the wall. In some dank cafe, she drank coffee, smoked a cigarette until it burned her fingers, waited for the red of dawn, and now she's gone. In my bed, I would have slept with her. Enfolded her in gown of night and held her body in a long continuum of dream. Dream that broken open in the light would split the seam of shadow. That animus we yearn for is not the act or acts of love, but spaces in between. In sleep, in dream, in rude exchange of breath, in secret turnings in the night, is found the deep. Sleep with me. Woman, lady is a word so laden with euphemistic kitsch that it obscures the laughter and the heat and inflicts deletions in the psyche. Females in their 20s in offices and kitchens in Phoenix and Wichita transist from girls to ladies without even a fair audition for the leading role of woman. Lady may once have had some elegance and grace, but now tastes bogus in the mouths of boys who use it to save face because they can't engage their glacial fear of women. If you're male, please don't introduce me to the little lady until you're eager to be known as little gentleman. I want the passion, intellect, and taste of woman. The prophet Debbie. Before she can assume her identity, we must lose our preconceptions of prophets. She cannot be found in the Book of Mormon, where there was no room for her. But she will make room for herself in the hearts of her people. She will wear a t-shirt, jeans, and boots, and in a little pouch around her neck carry polished stones. When she shows up at her home ward, she will not be recognized as anyone unusual, nor will she be called as a visiting teacher. But someone will later remember that at a ward dinner, she asked for a second helping of lime jello, after which she excused herself and left the cultural hall. Apocryphal stories will insist that as a young woman, she appeared at a rock concert in a meadow near Springville, Utah, where she boarded a band bus to calm a drunken Commander Cody, then mesmerized his musicians by speaking to them in tongues. One of her disciples will claim that he regained his sight by returning to that meadow to submerge in a polluted stream. I thought I may have encountered her myself at 7-Eleven, crying softly at the curb, wearing the requisite jeans, and drinking from a 2-quart bottle of Fisher beer. Accepted the hug that I gave her and the coffee I bought her in a big gulp cup. "My name is Debbie," she said. "You came here for a reason." 3 hours later, a woman in a long white dress and dark glasses appeared at my ward house, but I failed to recognize her. I have seen other signs of her coming. The woman who cut my hair at the dollar shop across from Banbury Cross Donuts told me she had birthed a miracle baby who would have died if not for a vision she witnessed during labor. When her understanding penetrated the long, dark tunnel of her vagina, umbilical cord wrapped around her daughter's neck, warned the doctor who untangled the cord, saved the child. But she had seen it first from the inside. She will not be found at the genealogical library, but someone will say they saw her buying used paperbacks at DI. It will be noticed that there is no garment line under her t-shirt. But she will introduce the sons of men to the moon circle and the daughters of women to Iron John. In her cellar is a 2-year supply of love. The prophet Debbie is waiting her call. And I am waiting too. Where the bodies are buried. Perky's in the front yard. blood-red rosebush forms a bower over her octagonal stone. Why did she survive her Easter morning shooting when her hour-long fight for life on a slab of bathroom marble in that $95 a month apartment, only to give up the ghost 8 years later beneath the Queen Anne desk in the dining room of our turn-of-the-century home? Boots is there, too, in a shoebox in an adjacent tomb. He was conspicuous even in shadow, stalking songbirds in his thigh-high white tops. Leukemia found him in the high grass, laid him low. Eep sleeps in the backyard, her shroud a brown cowl, her casket a coffee box. Wasn't dead for an hour before we laid her in the flower bed, said a prayer, and smudged her grave with sage to sanctify the ground. Family only at this service. Three graves by the tree off the alley on 12th East. Patty Ryan didn't protest, went limp. In my arms when Teddy Dankers ended his misery with a needle in the withers. BB died beneath the wheels of a friend's car, and we found the cheese cat, Perky's orange brother, dead on our doorstep one spring morning. Somewhere at North Fork, Muggins nests in snow and soil. Named for a mouse, she was never really a house cat. But in that vast outdoors, it's hard to be uncertain where she rests. Well, I'm going to read one more and let it be. Obscure objects of desire. Our bodies are our own misshapen artifacts of lust. In otherworldly orbits, they wobble on a tether we cannot control. The weather of our brain's electric selectivity interprets what we think we see and feel out there in alternating flashes of delight, despair. While they are remote from us, partly concealed from view, we own our bodies. They are our own, yet are not subject to us. Obscure objects of desire, they pull us through the void to other bodies and someone else's storm. Thank you. We've got a few minutes if you have questions. If I can operate this technology. Questions, comments, requests, suggestions for where we're going to lunch. Come on up.
Where are your publications available?
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. Mr. Caldiero has some publications with him for sale, is that correct? Yes. And Gino, with you today?
Yeah.
Hey.
You ask, we provide.
Dorothy?
My book will be out next spring or summer. I think next June. And In My Father's House is available at King's English and Sam Weller's.
And I have poems in various publications. I do not have a published collection. I have two collections waiting to find a publisher. So all you publishers out there, please rush up afterwards, will you please? All right. Other questions, comments? Oh, come on. Aren't you curious about something?
You don't like
I know. Well, I'll bring the mic to you.
Just like tackle.
What am I saying? I don't know that I'll do that. Well, thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun.